So I've been asked to introduce Luke Jansen, who's going to be talking about, is this your title right here?
Yes.
Pew Explore Evolution, Human Evolution and Religion. The Bible disagrees. Even scientists don't understand this stuff. It's not my problem anyway. And I'll let you say anything else you want about yourself before you begin.
That'll be it for now. Okay, first of all, thank you all for sticking around for the end of this this whole program, which was wonderful. And yes, this is a bizarre title. I get that. And no, it is not voice-to-text software picking up snippets of a phone conversation. This is three things you might hear. One might hear from Christians speaking about human evolution. And you'll understand a little bit more what I mean by that as I go through my talk. I work in a lab, so I bring a lab timer. What I want to do this morning is to cover two key questions. Is there a disconnect between the general public and scientists when it comes to a question so fundamental as human origins? And secondly, does this spill over into what we believe as Christians? Now, as I do that, I want to call attention to the actions and reactions of two groups among us, the first of which would be committed Christians, but especially white evangelical Protestants, of which I am one. And on the other hand, people rejecting Christian faith, especially our youth. So let's look into what I have to present here. We know that historically there have been many examples of Christian belief conflicting with science, with one group pointing to what they read in Scripture and the other group pointing to what they see all around them. It's that classical two books analogy that we've all heard of many a time. And perhaps one of the most infamous of these faith versus science disputes took place in the 17th century and it pitted the church against Galileo. I'm going to hold that event up a number of times in my talk as a precedent and an example, something that we should learn from and not repeat moving forward. At the heart of this dispute was the nature of the cosmos, and more specifically, one group insisted, based on numerous biblical passages, that the earth was motionless and immovable, at the center of the universe with all the other celestial bodies in motion around it. The other group insisted, based on observational data and abductive reasoning, that the Earth was anything but motionless and immovable. In fact, it was orbiting around the Sun at 67,000 miles per hour and spinning on its axis at 1,000 miles an hour if you're measuring at the equator. So anything but motionless and immovable. We all know how that dispute ended up. The Church eventually accepted the scientific explanation. Now, unfortunately, disputes such as these have been going on ever since, and today we're going to focus our attention on one particular dispute which has been really disruptive, even though we're really only still in the early stages. Many modern polling agencies have asked the public their opinion on a wide variety of matters, and I'm going to bring your attention to one carried out by Pew Research just a few years ago. You may be able to notice the date here, 2015. We can expect an update in 5 years. Ken Miller was giving a presentation, a wonderful one, two days ago, and he was referring to this disparity between the public and scientists on many things that I'll be talking about today. And he was talking about it in the 1960s, 1970s, 80s, 90s, and perhaps even a little bit more recently. But this is now 2015. This study is looking at that. So Pew talked to just over 2,000 members of the general public, as well as to nearly 4,000 members of the premier scientific organization in the United States, the American Association for the Advancement of Science. And I'll refer to that as the AAAS group. I want to emphasize that both of these groups comprise religiously minded people, including Christians, such as myself. So we're not comparing here atheist versus theist or Christian belief. We're comparing here scientifically trained versus scientifically naive groups of people, with an emphasis on the Christians in both groups. One part of this poll centered around a wide variety of science-related questions, and I'm sure many of you can't read this from the back of the room. My intent is not for you to be able to read these lines. I just want to give you an image of the scope of the study that was done here, and this is only a part of it. Here you see a list of questions that are all science-related. Seven different questions related to climate change and energy, three on government funding of research, one on evolution, six on various biomedical themes, two on food safety, one on animal research, and two on space exploration. So it's a very wide and diverse list of questions related to science. At the same time, they gathered demographic factors relating to the people that they were talking to in both of those groups. So things like party affiliation. Again, you may not be able to see this, but they asked the people about their political affiliation, their age, their level of science education, their gender, race, ethnicity, and then a couple questions related to religion, the religious attendance at a house of worship. And then they correlated all those demographic factors to see to what extent those demographic factors played into the answers that were given. And the more strongly that that particular demographic factor played in, the more darkly colored blue it is presented here. There's a ton of information even in this slide alone. That table alone will take us weeks to unpack. I want to call your attention to this one question in the middle of the study right here. Did humans evolve over long periods of time, or have they always existed in their present form? And not surprisingly, the answers to that question were heavily influenced by religious affiliation and by age. So let's look a little bit more closely at that. And we'll begin with the scientifically trained group of the public. It's probably no surprise, and I do that because they may be more able to deal with the scientific data, to digest the data and make sense of it. It's probably no surprise that this group are fairly unanimously in agreement that humans did evolve. 98 or 99% of them agree, depending on how you slice up this group, they would accept that statement. Humans, in fact, did evolve. If we look at the general public, we no longer see that near unanimity of opinion. In fact, almost a third of the general public would say that humans have always existed in their present form from the beginning. If we now take a look at whether religious affiliation of any kind plays a role in this, we can see that, in fact, it does. Now we only get half of these religiously affiliated people accepting the idea of evolution, 26 plus 27%, just a fraction over half. And if we also now look at particular streams of religious affiliation, now we see a very different, interesting story. Let me get by myself here. When we break it down into specific faith traditions of Protestant and Catholic, it is the Protestants who exhibit the least level of acceptance, and especially the white evangelical Protestants. Barely a third of them, 12 plus 22%, 33%, will accept human evolution, and the remaining two-thirds would say that humans have always existed in the present form. So clearly, the scientifically trained and scientifically naive groups of Christians are quite in conflict on this point of human evolution, even in 2015, and I think we'll find out next year with the update that's still the case today. Pew found three particularly intriguing observations related to this difference of opinion, and they were highlighted in the title for the talk, and I want to now go through them in a little bit more detail. You can read them there, but we'll begin with this first one. Even scientists don't believe this stuff. And I want you to listen to me carefully here. Pew found that the non-scientists looked into the minds of the scientists, and the non-scientists perceived that somehow the scientists aren't on board with some of these ideas. So you can see here, for example, a third of the non-scientists would say the scientists do not agree on the idea of human evolution. And even a half of the non-scientists believe that scientists are not agreed on the Big Bang cosmology. Clearly a disconnect. Now, look at these numbers again, the 29 and the 66% again. I'm going to put them on the other side there. And let's look again at what happens when we factor in religious affiliation. Once again, the feeling that scientists are divided seems to be held most strongly amongst the Protestants, and most particularly amongst the white evangelical Protestant Christians, of which, by the way, I'm one of them, so I'm not pointing fingers. I'm speaking to my own group here, and I think we're represented here in the crowd as well. The only way that I can perceive that disconnect is that it's a coping mechanism. And by that I mean the non-scientists, when faced with the data for human evolution and not wanting to accept it, will alleviate their cognitive dissonance, either their own or that of their readers and listeners, by saying, hey, even the scientists don't agree on this stuff. The second interesting trend that Pew found was that believers in general tend to not perceive the disconnect between religion and science, or they possibly even downplay it. In this case, a majority of the American public felt that science and religion are indeed in conflict. 60%, when asked, said, yes, science and faith are indeed in conflict. But when the question was made more personal, are they in conflict for you, the numbers drop by half. We go from 60 down to 30%. It seems to me what these people are saying is, okay, faith and science may be in conflict for other people, but it's not in conflict for me, myself. And I know I've heard that often in the academy and in church settings, and I'm sure you have as well. The third intriguing trend that Pew found was that, is somewhat related, but puts it into a more missional perspective. It has huge missional consequences. Pew found that by far the group of people who are most likely to perceive religion and science are those who are non-believers, those who seldom or never attend a house of worship, 3/4 of them, versus those who attend irregularly and especially those who attend on a regular weekly basis. It is those non-believers who we should be trying to reach out to with our faith, and yet they are the ones most likely to perceive that embracing faith means rejecting science. So faith and science are indeed in conflict, and this conflict is increasingly being felt with each new generation. Here's a study where they spoke to people who had been regular attenders at a church for long periods of their life and then stopped going. And we're not yet talking about why they left. We're just seeing they are looking at what fraction of these groups are leaving as time goes on. And the first time that they did this, they were speaking to, this was in 1971, speaking to people born in 1946 or earlier. They already found a measurable fraction of people who had disaffiliated, stopped going to church. And when they returned to that group at 10-year intervals, more and more of them had disaffiliated. We see the same thing in a slightly younger segment of the population, and then especially this youngest generation that was interviewed, those born between 1967 and 1986, when they were first asked, right at that point, already a substantial number of them, almost 1/4 of them, had disaffiliated, and when asked 10 years later, even more had left the church. The Barna Group is a faith-based polling agency and think tank that has explored in detail this disaffiliation from the church. They spoke to almost 1,300 people who had been regular churchgoers in their teen years but had since disconnected with the church. And those 1,300 people were asked the reasons why they stopped going to church. And many reasons were given. I'm not going to list them all here, but the three that are relevant to my talk today are these here. Churches are out of step with the scientific world we live in, Christianity is anti-science, or they've been turned off by the creation versus evolution debate. 1/3 to 1/4 of them resonated with each of these three statements. Now, this is what we find from a theist, a religiously based organization. Here are some data from the opposite end of the spectrum. Here we have an anti-theist group talking to just over 2,000 members of their constituency, asking essentially the same questions. One question, but they're asking it in two parts. If you left the Christian faith, what was your greatest reason for doing so, and what do you consider to be the greatest obstacle to belief in the Christian God? And a substantial number of them that resonated with the statement, Christian teachings that conflict with the findings of modern science. That feeling was shared by 54% of those of that group as well. Shouldn't this trend of disaffiliation be concerning the Christian church? Shouldn't it be concerning the academy that's training ministry leaders to lead those individual churches? How should we be teaching differently, training differently, perhaps even thinking and believing differently? The Barna Group, again, that faith-based polling agency, had this to say about youth leaving the church. They said, the problem arises from the inadequacy of preparing young Christians for life beyond youth group. Only a small minority of young Christians has been taught to think about matters of faith, calling, and culture. Later on in their discussion of the data, that study that I showed you a couple slides ago, they then address the response that many people will give, which is, it's because those kids are going to university and being exposed to those bad ideas like evolution. And they said this about that. The university setting does not usually cause the disconnect. It simply exposes the shallow faith problem of many young disciples. Much of the ministry to teenagers in America needs an overhaul, not because the church has failed to attract significant numbers of young people. Many of us in this room probably go to church that has a large youth group. The problem is not getting the kids in there. Instead, much of those efforts are not creating a sustainable faith beyond high school. The lack of adequate preparation begins at a very young age. Many of our churches still use the stories of Adam and Eve, Noah's Ark, and the Tower of Babel as core elements of their Sunday school programs. And they're often taught by adults who may not necessarily believe the story themselves. Those stories, those children will inevitably be confronted with alternative versions of those same stories when they go to school or into the workforce as adults. And those alternative versions will be fully supported by scientific data. For many of those kids, this will set the stage for a crisis of faith. And many of them will make the choice to give up their faith or put their faith in the back burner so far that it becomes meaningless and irrelevant. And I speak from personal experience when I say that. So we need to be teaching, preaching. We need to be teaching, preaching, thinking differently on many levels. The one issue in particular that I'm focusing on today has been that of human evolution. We're not preparing our youth for that, despite we're not preparing our youth or our churches or our ministry leaders despite the fact that they will inevitably encounter those ideas. Many of our churches continue to preach around the story of a primal couple in the Garden of Eden who made a choice to set the course of human history on a downward path of death and destruction. And the Academy has done likewise. Both the Church and the Academy continue to refer to this story in a way that makes it sound historical. They frequently leave their listeners and trainees with this image of Adam and Eve and the fall in the garden, an instantaneous beginning and a downward spiral. Rarely, if ever, do they emphasize the possible metaphorical nature of this story, and almost never do they ever present an alternative scientific explanation of human origins and how to fit that into Christian theology. Much of what is taught is founded on this paradigm. Things like biblical history, Christology, Pauline studies, atonement theology, cross-cultural missions, the Imago Dei, creationism we just heard from, many of these ideas, concepts, sermons, and courses are taught from this paradigm. But the fact that the new scientific data call into question the very existence of a primal couple and the fall should prompt a reinterpretation of any theology that's based on their existence, their actions, or the genealogy. We now have abundant evidence that humans never originated from a primal pair in an instantaneous fashion, but instead arose gradually over a very extended branching tree of closely related species, and eventually along a line of more closely related hominid species, both extinct and extant. I'm referring here to, on the one hand, Denisovans and Neanderthals, and on the other hand, chimpanzees and gorillas. And how have we been on the downward spiral? I would argue that humans have been on an upper climb in many ways that one would try to measure our progress over the millennia. Physically, anatomically, intellectually, cognitively, morally, religiously, even theologically, we've been on this upward climb. And if I had many more minutes to give this talk, I would substantiate or try to substantiate those claims. Or you can see how I've addressed that in an article that was published in the Society's Journal just last year. And how have we fallen? Certainly not in any way from a position of perfection, either in a literal or a metaphorical sense of that word. But I think we can redefine fallenness as falling short of a goal, of our potential. We've been on this upward climb. Isn't that the very meaning of the biblical words that the Bible? Isn't that the very meaning of the words that the Bible uses for sin, hata and hamartia, the Hebrew and Greek words that are borrowed from archery? And they have in them, embedded in those words, this idea of being on a trajectory and falling short of our ultimate goal of the intended target. We need a theology that embraces these scientific contradictions to the traditional Christian understanding of human ontology. We need to be much more clear what we mean when we use the words the fall, or being fallen creatures, or being broken image bearers. Those terms have accrued too much baggage, distracting baggage, and we need to come up with other terms and be more clear what we mean when we refer to the fall and other things like that. So to conclude, Christians in the past have opposed a scientific model of the cosmos which appeared to contradict many passages of Scripture, favoring instead the three-tiered model of the cosmos, built around a direct or literal reading of Scriptures and a long-standing tradition of the Church Fathers. More recently, when science gave its Big Bang cosmology and human evolution, we rejected those as well. The Church rejected those as well. And for the very same reason, that they contradicted too much Scripture and a long-standing tradition of the Church Fathers, favoring instead the narratives given in Genesis. Since then, the Church has gradually come around to the scientific model of cosmology, replacing the three-tiered model with the scientific one, largely because the mountain of evidence became too large to ignore, reject, or defy. Cardinal Robert Bellarmine, who was appointed by the Pope to oversee this Galileo affair, he had this to say about it. He said, regarding the heliocentric model, that he could accept it if sufficient proof for it could be given. And it was. And as far as the contradictions between Scripture and science, he wrote, one would then have to proceed with great care in explaining the Scriptures that appear to be contrary, and say rather that we do not understand those Scriptures, rather than what is demonstrated scientifically is false. This is exactly what I think we need to do now, again, in this context, the current context of Christian theology encountering human evolution. In the course of some studies, I came across a quote from another book. This is on an entirely different subject, postmodernism. But they, too, referred to the Galileo affair. And what they had to say there, again, I found just resonated perfectly with our current situation regarding human evolution. They said, The first great mistake of the church was to react so negatively to the rise of the new science. The Christian church could have responded differently. It could have asked if its traditional interpretations were correct. It could have rearticulated the Christian faith for a new time. It didn't have to be this way. And I don't think it needs to be this way today when the Christian church, Christian theology, grapples with human evolution and tries to fit it into our theology. Unfortunately, Pew have shown us that much of the church still generally rejects a scientific consensus about cosmological origins, otherwise known as Big Bang cosmology. But the church is ever so slowly giving ground to that as well. But just the same, that delay and that resistance has contributed to a regrettable loss of our youth and our unbelieving neighbors. And altogether, they altogether feel that 21st century science makes Christian faith a ridiculous choice. However, Christian thinking has been evolving over the recent past, and perhaps now is the time for yet another paradigm change with respect to human origins. So with that, I'd like to conclude. I welcome any feedback, any comments or questions that you have about what I've presented to you today. Thank you.
And I guess the thrust of what you're saying, I didn't actually know exactly what you were talking on. Was actually a think tank at this meeting was there on Friday, and you weren't at that, I think, but I had 2 minutes to propose a dangerous idea to discuss, and I think one of the dangerous ideas is that inerrancy issues with the Bible. And this concept is around how we interpret the Bible and use the Bible, and they're not helpful for the kinds of discussions that you're saying we need to be having. And I guess one of my comments is that we need to, I know this talk's starting soon, but also a big gap here, we need to sort of workshop these ideas. And I've been doing that at each lunch and coffee break and saying, what do you think about this, what do you think about that? And yeah, there's actually, I think, opportunities for better theology, because we're being informed in new ways that Calvin, that we've heard about, could not have been informed about. And our faith is a revisionist faith, really. Paul was a revisionist. Luther was a revisionist. Mm-hmm. We have to meet the need of our age.
Right.
And I just want to take my hat off to what you're doing. And I think we need to begin together talking about these things. Mm-hmm. It can't be the people of the pew. It's got to be the people who are informed, and we need to have the theologians and scientists in this great debate and come up with better theology. And I think it's there. We just need to.
Right. Well, I fully endorse that comment, and thank you for bringing it to us.
Actually, my comment is kind of similar. I appreciate the what you brought forward, and particularly interested in your slide showing the possible theological insight, or at least interpretation that we present to younger people of human development being more positive than the fall being falling short of. Could be. That has a lot of potential. I know Dale Gentry is in here. Presented something a day or two ago. He wants to develop short videos aimed at young people to be shown on YouTube. And I hope you two can get together, because the kind of message on that slide is something that I think would resonate with young people.
Right. We'll certainly contact
him
if you have a department.
So I was thinking a little bit about one of the things you said about replacing language about fall sin nature or things in that arena. I'm curious to hear what you suggest to use as language instead of that. I read self-help stuff, but I feel like, I feel like we all could, you know, wake up earlier and weigh less and do more work on our different projects and be better people in various ways. But that the gospel addresses something much deeper than not meeting our full human potential. It's saying there is a problem in our relationship with God. So one of my questions is just again, what would you use as language instead? And then there's kind of an additional question. We chatted about that the other day after another talk. What happened in Genesis 2:7? You know, because what was it when God was breathing life? Something happened that distinguishes us from the animals. So if you want to address one or both, but especially that thing about what language should we use?
Right, so the truth is I hadn't thought about that. I was thinking about that while you were speaking, and a word that came to mind was imperfect. If we're speaking to other Christians or non-Christians, and we say we're fallen creatures, the non-Christians at least are going to say, what do you mean we're fallen creatures? And many of the Christians will say, who struggles with this concept of fallenness, because I haven't seen how that plays out in history, in human history. But you say we're imperfect beings. Everybody's going to say, yeah, we're imperfect beings. We're imperfect species. And so that's my first suggestion to you. That we might replace the word saying we're fallen creatures, replace that with we're imperfect creatures. That's a quick answer. I'd have to think more about that to develop that.
And I just feel there's a difference between imperfect and morally in opposition to a perfect God.
It's a difference between imperfect and morally. I'm still trying to make a connection to what you just said. I didn't quite get your question.
Sorry. So, I felt imperfect is a good start, but that imperfect just suggests some of us get ill and die sooner than we need to. Our bodies are not perfect, or we don't relate with our families in a perfect way. But wrong or evil is a different category. It goes much deeper.
Right.
So if you may be able to comment on that, and of course.
Right, so I think, yeah, and I guess we are very short time, so I'll be really quick. So I think I'm getting your point. There is a difference, so I can still say that, and everyone, I think, can say that we could have been like this, but we fell short of our potential. Some people fail far from their potential. Hitler would be an example, a classic example, which you're not supposed to use ever in an argument. But even on the national basis, various countries this is hard to do in a few seconds. So yes, you're saying we need to grapple with the whole idea of how far fallen we are, how far imperfect we are, and you still can fall very short of the goal, or fall slightly short of the goal. All of us have fallen short of the goal, but to some extent more than others. I don't know, we'll have to talk about it later.
Well, we'll leave it there.
Yes.
Thank Luke again. That concludes this session.